Okay, well, first of all, welcome to this very crowded meeting. I'm very pleased to see such large numbers of people here, so welcome to the LSE for those of you who are at the LSE, and welcome to the LSE if you're not at the LSE, and particularly welcome to LSE Ideas, of which I'm the director, and my name is Professor Mick Cox, and I'm very pleased to be here this evening chairing what I think is going to be a great discussion between three great speakers. Can you hear me okay at the back? I've got a very loud voice, as you know, but anyway. Good. So that's terrific, and it's good to see such a large number of people here tonight. Nobody else can come in now, by the way. That's it. Stop the doors. The subject of tonight's debate or discussion between our three eminent speakers is sustainable development goals. And the event, to read out the formalities here, is to introduce the audience to sustainable development goals from a global perspective, with an emphasis on how young leaders can impact these goals in their own personal and professional capacities. As I said, we have three speakers here this evening. I've asked all of them to speak for no more than 15 minutes, and I think that'll mean 15 minutes, so I'll start shaking my fist when they go beyond that. Because what we want to do is encourage the discussion not only from up here, but from down there. I won't spend a lot of time introducing people. They will go in the order I've got them here. So, Paul, you do go first. Allah, you definitely go second. And Fulmi, it's not because you're at King's that you're going third, but you're on my list here, you're going third. So no discrimination, but welcome anyway. We always love our friends from across the road at King's, and they love us too, as you know. Well, we try to love each other anyway. Paul, I think, needs very little introduction. CEO of Unilever and a member of the SDG Advocacy Group. And Paul has been CEO of Unilever since January 2009. And I think under his leadership, Unilever has an ambitious vision, as it says, to fully decouple growth from overall environmental imprint and increase its positive social impact through Unilever's sustainable living plan. Allah, whom I'm delighted to have here this evening. I say delighted in a very special way, because Allah's doing a course here at the LSE at the moment, and you've still survived, Allah. Oh, yeah, you're looking pretty good, I have to say. But Allah's been doing a master's here with us in LSE Ideas. Been a great contributor to the class, has energized us all and made us think quite a lot about things sometimes we don't like to think about. But Allah's got a wonderful CV and is obviously going to go on to do very great things. And in January of 2016, Allah was selected as one of 17 Sustainable Development Goals advocates by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. So we look forward to what Allah will be saying. And then finally, Funmi Olan, I hope I get the pronunciation right here, Olan Inesakin is director of the Africa Leadership Group over at King Centre. I'm sorry, I do beg your pardon. That's what it said down here. At King's College, and founding director of the African Leadership Centre. I do beg your pardon. And in January of 2015, Professor was appointed by the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon as one of the seven members of the advisory group of experts on the review of the UN peacebuilding architecture. So three terrific speakers on a wonderful and important theme. Paul, I'll hand over to you straight away and welcome again to the LSE and welcome to LSE Ideas.
Thanks for the opportunity and certainly happy to be here. Allah and I are both SDG advocates, and once he called me and says, this is the panel you need to be on, I said, okay, no doubt in my mind to participate. I don't know how, it's quite a big audience, so it's a little bit difficult to know at what level everybody is on the SDGs, and if we're going to talk to a few or to many, it's a little bit difficult to assess at this time. But let me just first of all say happy to be part of this panel, and also at LSE. I work a lot with Nick Stern on the Grantham Research Center here, where we've actually changed quite dramatically the debate around climate change, mm-hmm. which is goal number 13 of the SDGs, and I would argue actually permeates more or less 13 of the 17 or 14 of the 17 goals easily. You cannot have the food security or the forests or the oceans or gender equality or, people would argue, education and many of the other things if you don't tackle climate change. The two biggest challenges of this century are not new to anybody here, but they're actually more transparent, which is the development challenge and climate change, and they're actually closely related. And they, I always say they're two sides of the same coin. Climate, if you, you cannot have development if we don't tackle the issue of climate change. And by tackling the climate change issues, you actually drive development. In this world, unfortunately, we're already past 1 degree, and we're rapidly approaching the 1.5 degrees, which many people would argue is actually the maximum that we need to be at. We got a good agreement in Paris, but we need much more. If we don't tackle that very quickly, according to the World Bank, just quoting them, about 100 million people would fall back into poverty in the next, you know, next decade or so. So it's a crucial time for mankind. And we're all really important that we all play a role in this. This is a world made up of all of us. And if we all rise to that challenge, I think we can create a better world for all. There are many things that are coming together here right now that are a little bit confusing, but I like to start with the most positive side is, and the most positive side actually is, if you look at the last 3 or 4 decades, we've never lifted so many people out of poverty. There are more people in education than any time in the history of mankind, more people having access to education, child mortality has come down. Actually women, although there's a lot more to do, have more opportunities now than in any time in history. So I can take a lot of these things and actually say it's the best time to be born now. It's the best time to enter this global economy. But at the same time, we've discovered that there are some new challenges that are emerging on the horizon that have a certain sense of urgency to be treated. Because we've lifted so many people out of poverty, China being a big part of that, we have done that with a linear consumption model. We dig in the earth, we produce all the things we need only for a certain group of people, and then we dump it in the landfill or in the oceans. Packaging, a great example, only 10% of the packaging in this world gets recycled. So how many times can we dig in the earth before we end up in Australia is a very good question. And we are actually trying to, we are actually approaching some of these planetary boundaries. John Rockström, who runs the Stockholm Resilience Institute, talks about these biomarkers of how well the health of the Earth is. And 4 of those, climate change, biodiversity, nitrogen levels, are actually beyond what he already calls minimal acceptable levels. And every day we see the evidence of that. It's the flip side of having lifted so many people out of poverty. But let me give you one little statistic, that unfortunately the top 1.4 billion people in this world are consuming 75% of the world's resources. And the bottom 1%, 1 billion people, only 1%. And yet they all aspire to live like the rest. So if we don't change this economic system from produce to have economic advancement, we will not make it. The sustainable development goals, so that's the one trend, is the population growth. The other trend that is coming together, which is very important, is actually technology and the internet. Lots of good things happening with technology, because you provide financial inclusion to women, for example. You can go to smallholder farmers now and they can see on their mobile phone what the prices are. Many success stories in the emerging markets where people are unlocking their potential because of technology. But there's a flip side of technology as well. One of the flip sides of technology obviously is that if you're not in the game of technology and are excluded, you have a higher chance now to be poor. It's not just income, it's technology defined. The other thing we have to watch about is, if you think about a world of virtual reality, artificial intelligence and all the other things, we driverless cars, peopleless checkout counters in the supermarkets, some people think that we're about at the biggest wave of job destruction that is going to happen in human mankind. So we are already in a world where 3.5 billion people have marginal jobs, $1.75 a day or less, marginal jobs, and then we have 2 billion more people coming into this world. If we are going to create a technology wave, which some people call the fourth industrial revolution, of job destruction, that's a big problem. Houston, we have a problem. We need to think about solving that. And not many people are talking that. The other thing with technology is it has given us all a voice, has given us all an opportunity. Whilst wealth might be very concentrated now, 1% of the world's people have the same wealth as the bottom 99%. Interestingly, wealth is very concentrated. Power is actually very dispersed because of technology. Makes it difficult. Makes it difficult for governments to operate. Makes it difficult for people to have intellectual opinions. It's instant gratifications. News comes in little sound bites. And the world is becoming actually in that sense more polarized than united. And the third big trend that we have next to technology and planetary boundaries is a challenge, which is that the institutions that have dealt with the global problems in this world were actually designed at the time of Bretton Woods, when 80-90% of the world economy was in Europe and the US. So it was easy. We designed the IMF, we designed the World Bank, the WTO, the OECD, the Security Council at the UN. But now the world has moved on. 80% of the world population is going to live very shortly outside of Europe and the US. And we don't have a global governance system. And yet the issues that we now need to deal with have become global. The global financial markets, the global tax system, climate change, technology, privacy, all these things have become global issues. And there's not really a mechanism to deal with that. Now, the good thing is that despite all the things we like to say about our governments, who don't very well represent us or sometimes disappoint us, they did rise to the challenge in 2015. In 2015 was, in my opinion, one of the best and most encouraging years, because in September we got about 193 countries at the UN signed what we call the Sustainable Development Goals, which were the follow-up of the Millennial Development Goals. Millennial Development Goals started in the year 2000, finished in 2015. Basically, focused on the emerging markets with 8 goals. A little bit simple, because those were different problems at that time. Now, big breakthrough, Sustainable Development Goals. 17 goals, because the world is a little bit more complex. The word sustainable is in it. And it has a one simple objective, which I think is amazing, which is to irreversibly eradicate poverty in a more sustainable and equitable way. Poverty, sustainable, equitable. It's a universal agenda. And the more we work this or look at this, it can be done in the next 15 years. And then the first test of these 17 goals was in Paris in December, which everybody said was the COP21 climate change. And lo and behold, which is goal number 13, by the way. So lo and behold, again, these same governments come together. Despite all the odds of not reaching agreements and the world not ready for this, and they signed the agreement. A trajectory that was 4 degrees is being bent to a trajectory to 2.7 degrees. And they agreed to meet again every 5 years. They agreed to put $100 billion there for financing. They agreed to make it, some of these parts of it, legally binding. And we are putting ourselves on a path, obviously, of correcting the issues. So here we are. We could be the generation in the next 15 years that solves the issue of poverty and that solves the issue of climate change. Nobody else has done it before us. Nobody else has to do it after us. Tremendously motivating. Tremendously motivating. But now it's hard work, because we all know it's easy to make declarations. But I always say reputations are not made by what people say, but by what people do. I'm up supposedly on this panel to represent business. So let me try to do that, although I always say I represent one of the biggest NGOs. We are actually not a government organization. So I always say we're one of the biggest NGOs. But let me just talk the point of business for a second. This global development agenda obviously costs money. Nothing comes for free. There are some other issues related to that we can talk later. The bill of implementing this agenda is actually $2 to $3 trillion a year. $2 to $3 trillion is actually 3% or so of the global economy. It sounds like a lot, but it's not at all. If it's only 3% of the global economy, we should be able to handle these issues. It's ridiculous that we accept for 2 to 3% extra investment, which by the way has zero cost nowadays, interest rates are zero, that we accept 800 million people to go to bed hungry, not knowing if they wake up the next day. It's ridiculous that we accept for 2 to 3% investment that we have still 2.5 billion people not having access to sanitation or clean drinking water. It's ridiculous that we still let 4 million people die every year of infectious diseases like pneumonia or diarrhea that we could solve with some simple things if we get our acts together. So where do the 2 to 3 trillion come from? That's where business comes in, because all the overseas development aid, what you call ODA, all the money that the governments pay, and the UK has made a commitment to pay 0.7% of GDP, very good in this case from the UK, but it all adds up to only about $160 billion. So $160 billion, and the number is going down because the governments are trying to solve their deficits. If the agenda is 2 to 3 trillion, you need to have business there by investing these billions to unlock these trillions, otherwise it's not going to work. Business also, obviously, if you look at all of these goals, the 17 goals have 169 targets. I looked at these 169 targets in much detail. About 140 of them require business to be solved. Business comes in with technologies or innovations or people or capacity. They need to be part of that. Most of the developing markets, business itself is about 60% of the GDP of those countries. It's about 80% of the financial flow. And in today's world, about 90% of the job creation. So you can't solve it without business. The whole debate, should they be included or not, and is obviously a theoretical debate. Where we should focus on is trust. Is there trust? I'm done in 5 minutes. I see the clock there as well. It's actually, you have a good mechanism in the... So the issue is not should business be involved or not. It has to be if we want to solve the agenda, but we have to overcome this trust barrier. Now, for business itself, is an enormous opportunity. Because this agenda, although the investments are 2 to 3 trillion, the payouts for society are 20 to 30 trillion. McKinsey calculated just giving women, goal number 5, which is gender equality, just giving women equal opportunities as men, equal access to education, equal access to financing and training, land rights, just equal, we're not asking for more, is unlocking the global economy by 28 trillion. Now you look at some small investments, $1 investment in nutrition gives a $6 payout. $1 investment in education increases someone's lifetime income by 20 to 30%. Any of these investments you now look at, because we've gotten to this point, have better payouts than most businesses can give you within their own business plans. So if we can unlock that potential, it's an enormous opportunity for business. There is no business case in enduring poverty. If we don't develop these economies and make them more inclusive, then businesses will also be limited in their opportunities to grow. And obviously businesses need to understand that they have to be an active part of the solutions. Because the only reason that business can exist long-term, in my opinion, is because societies accept them to exist. If businesses would make things worse, which is the case for many businesses now, they pollute and they don't pay for it, or they have different social standards in their value chains, or they, you know, sell horse meat instead of beef, society doesn't accept that anymore in this age of transparency. So business has to become an active participant in addressing these sustainable development goals. And by doing so, they actually create enormous opportunities. We're in the bar soap business because part of Unilever's business is hygiene products and part of it is food products. So if more and more people wash their hands, it's a good thing for the world. But I also will sell more bar soap. There's nothing wrong with that. It's an enlightened self-interest for businesses to drive this development agenda. Now, where is change coming from? Change is coming from three things. First, change is coming from transparency. That's where the internet comes in. Good things, bad things of the internet, overall positive for me, because there's no place to hide anymore. The reason you open the Financial Times every day and there's a company in there with a scandal is not because companies are worse now than they were before. It's just that the world is more transparent. Tinkling with your car engine or manipulating your LIBOR rates or foreign exchange rates or not investing in the safety of your well or treating your people badly and the factory in Rana Plaza is collapsing in Bangladesh is now a world problem in 2 seconds. And increasingly people are saying, hey, we need to do something about it. So transparency builds trust. It's a wonderful opportunity to do that. The second reason I'm optimistic is actually that the cost of not acting is becoming higher than the cost of acting. If someone read today an article in the US, for example, this is the first time that most of the energy investments in the US for new energy is going in clean energy, in going into wind or solar. Because we are seeing now that because of technology and all the other things, it's becoming cheaper. The cost of not acting is starting to become higher than the cost of acting. So that's a good thing because the economic system still rules in this world if we like it or not. And the third reason I'm optimistic is because of the millennials. If you look at the millennials, they are far more purpose-driven. Most of them don't want to work for corporates anymore. They want to make a difference in life. Most of the social entrepreneurs coming in now, they're creative. They have different thinking that is not programmed like ours. They understand that it's their future and they don't want to just be part of it, they want to actively help shape it. They understand that actually they need to be part of that solution. When we worked on the Sustainable Development Goals, I was part of the high-level panel for the Secretary General putting in the recommendations. We put a website out there which was called The World We Want. Within a nanosecond, which was in about a week or 2 weeks period, we had over 1 million people writing down what was the world they wanted, and they were young people. They were lots of them from Africa. So millennials, transparency, cost of not acting versus cost of acting are actually positive forces that are driving us there. And the first one where you see it is actually on climate change already. Tremendous momentum. Are we moving in the right direction? Without any doubt. Are we moving fast enough? No. So where do we put all of our energy to accelerate that transformation? It's all about acceleration. Don't spend your time on arguing, are we doing it or are we not doing it? Or is it right to be sustainable? You're wasting your time. We've passed that thing. All what you need to do is to say, how do we accelerate? And the only way we can accelerate is put the right people together to create a tipping point. Don't expect the whole world to go. Expect the right people to set the example and make that the standard for others to follow. We can talk about that later. 5 minutes are up.
Perfect. Absolutely wonderful. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I'll hand over after that inspirational beginning over to Alla. Alla, over to you.
Hello. Thank you, Paul, for making it clear we don't have to argue that the Sustainable Development Goals are useful. But for the cynics out there, I will give a little anecdote. When I first got involved with the UN, I was 21. I had started my own organization, which focused on women's participation in peace processes and conflict resolution. Now, many of you here may know that less than 1% of mediators are women in peace processes. There has never been a lead negotiator as a woman in a peace process, in a UN-sanctioned peace process. So when I was 21 in the country of Libya in North Africa, following the revolution in 2011, I started an organization which focused on women's inclusion in peace processes. And this happened in a country where there was no infrastructure, there were no institutions, a respect for justice was minimal at best. And the UN came in through a political mission and they said, listen, we're here to help. And I had a very, very poor feeling about the UN. I had seen the UN's work in other conflict situations and I felt like the UN was not the necessary body, was complicating things more than it was helping. It was uncoordinated. There are 14 UN families. So you have, you know, UN women here, UNDP here, UNFPA here. Everybody was running amok. They were all asking the same questions, making the same promises, and people felt very, very deflated by the UN very quickly. So when I was first asked to get involved with the Sustainable Development Goals, my initial reaction was, what a joke. It's the UN, and they can't do anything properly. I hope nobody here is working for the UN. Okay. but then I actually started to learn more about them and to actually work on them. And as Paul had mentioned, the World We Want program and the 6 million people who had given us ideas of what they wanted the world to look like. And there were a few key goals which I was more interested in. And I don't think I should say that, but I will. The first, because I'm a medical doctor, was health. If you don't have good health, you can't really go very far in life. The second for me was gender equality. It was something that I had worked on very passionately in Libya. It was something that I believed in. And I strongly believe that if you do not have all the voices at the table, be it minorities, be it women, nothing will get done. It will not be sustainable. It cannot only be in the interests and likeness of one group. And the third, and in my view, the most important, was Goal 16. Which was peace, justice, and strong institutions. And I felt this way because I had been raised in Canada until I was 15, and then I moved to Libya, and I saw the difference that strong institutions can make. We can all talk about economic sustainability. We can all talk about teaching somebody to fish instead of giving them fish. But they realistically can't go to the lake because it is too dangerous or they will get killed. Then they're not going to go. You can't start by teaching people things that they can never have access to. You cannot tell a battered woman to leave her husband if she has nowhere to go, nowhere to put her kids, and no sense of accountability for what has happened. So for me, Goal 16 was what got me strongly involved. And it became about, okay, so if we're going to talk about peace, justice, and strong institutions, those have to be created by people locally. They have to be legitimate. We all, I think, understand that institutions created by others for you in neocolonial fashion just doesn't work. They've led to countless wars. They don't seem to work. So then how can we enable people locally to create institutions which are in their likeness, institutions which actually respect their beliefs, their values, their norms, while still respecting the international ones? So this became a huge challenge, and as we went around the world and started looking in different societies, and I sit as a high commissioner for the WHO on health, and so health was the area I focused in. How do we create institutions which respect, as Paul was saying, these technological advancements and all these new things, but at the same time are ethical, are sustainable, are supportive for their communities? And it became clear that it was with youth. And I use youth very liberally because I want to call myself youth when I'm about 55, 60. So I use youth very
65,
liberally.
69?
80, 85. My little sisters think I'm old already, so it's okay. Because I don't know what damn Daniel means or something. I don't know. But what was key to me was actually what people can do locally. And this created a larger conversation about leadership, which Funmi and I have had often, which is that when we talk about leadership, we often talk about the presidents and the CEOs and the prime ministers, and that's wonderful. You know, when I ask you guys, name some leaders for me, some of you might say Martin Luther King Jr. and Nelson Mandela, and they are leaders. I won't undermine that in any way. But we have to recognize that in order for people to be successful at that level, in order for them to have a message to amplify, there has to be mobilization on the ground. And that mobilization often comes from locals. It comes from women in particular, who lead over 70 to 80% of civil society globally. And it comes from youth, people who often aren't represented in political and institutional structures. So that, to me, became the clear gap. How do we get people who are creating and mobilizing these changes on the ground to be the people who create the institutions, to be the people who actually drive peace and justice? Now, I don't have any of those answers. I'm hoping that all of you come up with them, and then I'll take all the credit. But what I do think is key is when we sit here and when we talk about how we can enable these sustainable development goals, what we can do, be it in climate change or in clean water or in quality healthcare or quality education, I think we have to actually be respectful. We have to be realistic. Not everybody lives in the same society and environment we live in. And we have to recognize that the initiatives that are going to be sustainable, things that will actually take hold in communities, have to be part of they have to be indigenous to that community. They have to be something that the community builds with it. They cannot be imposed and they cannot be copied and pasted. And I know a lot of you will go on to very successful careers where you might work on these goals. Or you might work in areas which affect these goals, and I hope you do, be it through business or through policy, and take that with you, that it is essential for us to start working in communities the way we would want others to work in our own. That is the only way. When we are talking about sustainability, we can always talk about superficial sustainability. We can always talk about climate change and et cetera, et cetera. But we cannot talk at people. And in a large part of the world where these goals are most needed, we need to learn to listen. So that is what I think we can do. And you can all yell at me in your questions.
And finally on to Funmi.
Try
that for me, because I think that's probably the safer of the option. Would you want to turn that down?
Yeah, I think it's probably better to do.
You didn't even need three microphones. You only needed one. Sustainability.
Okay, all right, okay.
Look at us. That's an example of amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think I'll literally start from where Alan stopped. You're right. We're very much agreed on a number of things. What fascinates me about the SDGs is Goal 16. In 2000, I was just actually arriving at the UN. We celebrated the MDGs, and very quickly we realized that there was a missing goal. And everybody said, where's the security component to this? For those of you who work in conflict-affected regions, you know we can talk about development all we want. Without peacefulness, without an environment in which there's absence of that physical violence that you experience, and indeed, of course, the structural violence, but you know, the direct violence that just makes everything stop, makes you run to look for shelter, makes you just really afraid every day. Without being able to secure yourself and feel secured in that way, you cannot really talk about real development, let alone a sustainable one. Of course, in the UN at the time, everybody said, oh, we just concluded the MDGs. There's no appetite for any conversation around security. So, of course, one realizes very quickly that if you're going to get anywhere beyond where we were, where we are now, you have to put security on the table. I think there's something about Goal 16 that is very delicate, but that actually becomes the anchor goal, the anchor for all these things that we're talking about. I love Allah's, you know, conversations around health, because for those of you who study peace, Galtung connects peace with health very much. I mean, connected this in the early part of his work. Goal 16, promoting peaceful and inclusive societies for sustainable development, provision of access to justice for all, the building of inclusive and accountable institutions at all levels. Really, really lofty. And actually, if you have that, you're probably well on your way to development. But if we talk about this new generation, if we talk about young people, two questions. How can Goal 16 become realizable in the face of the persistent challenge to peace and security, to which the UN has devoted much attention and hasn't had much success? And what must we do differently in order to shift or transform the space in which we work, especially if we're focusing on these goals? I'm not trying to be pessimistic. I'm just saying that there are real obstacles to achieving this kind of lofty agenda. So, where am I coming from if I'm talking to academics and talking to young people, and colleagues who are going to research and are going to be expected to say very, very nice things in the places where you work? I think we need to realize that we have to go back to the drawing board. And I'm speaking as an international community, not as an African that is affected directly and indirectly on a day-to-day basis by these things. I think the leadership question is key. You mentioned that. And our approach to leadership as academics, as policy actors, is just on the wrong side of history and on the wrong side of reality. When I sat in the UN, I was on the task force at the time that dealt with the crisis in Sierra Leone. When you sat in the task force, and of course I worked on the agenda of children affected by armed conflict, we were the lesser mortals when it came to the business of security at the United Nations. And if you spoke on the ground to anyone, even till today, people would say, let's deal with the business of security first before we talk about children and women. These are appendages most of the time. In any resolution, you then suddenly realize that people remember, and they add, oh, yes, and other vulnerable groups, including women and children. It could be anything else at the end of the line. But then people would say, who are the good guys? Now, the leadership question in business is more straightforward than the leadership question in a security and development context. Because in business, you need a CEO, you can say what traits you want them to have, you can tell what results you want them to generate, and that will happen quickly. But in an unstructured setting, where everything has gone wild, where everyone has gone mad, and you're asking who the good guys are, it's difficult. As good as Kaba was, the late President Kaba was, and as friendly as he was to those he was with at UNDP, the problem of bringing peace to Sierra Leone was not his alone to solve. And intellectually and practically, the challenge of leadership is to understand that we're not dealing in a vertical hierarchy when we're dealing with societies affected by conflict to which we want to bring peace. Rather, you're dealing with a relationship, and therefore the key question to ask is, who are the people exchanging influence in their common situation? Because that exchange of influence, in which there's mutuality, in which you see people seeing that there's no clean water, there's very poor roads, that's where you see leadership. It's not at the top of the vertical hierarchy. And research so far in the context of security and development has proven that you have to take a different approach to leadership, and you cannot hope to build any institution that lasts without doing that. It means that leadership is generated locally. It means that it is generated in the spaces where people have common purpose and mutual needs on a day-to-day basis. So when we take a UN resolution and wave it at people on the ground, top down, actually what we're doing is offering leadership, but still a different kind of leadership. More or less, What you do in a conflict-affected setting is build an exchange of influence between the United Nations and the local leaders on the ground, who might not be exchanging influence with the population that they're supposed to serve. And I can give you numerous examples. And one of the biggest failures we've had in South Sudan is the fact that we built an exchange of influence between the international community through a state-building program that built peace and wound a peace agreement around two leaders who had raped the economies of their countries and actually continue to plunder the place in other ways. So what would change in our approach, and what ought to change in our approach if we want to build peaceful and inclusive societies? The narrative has to change. The analysis has to change. It cannot be institution building at all cost towards forming a particular kind of institution. Because if we take that approach, we forget that, and of course there's a whole debate to be had with our colleagues at the UN as well, especially at UNDP, because they tell you institution building is first, you have to go and build institutions. Brahimi will tell you it is you build institutions, you build nations. Brahimi will tell you that it is arrogance, to say the least, to think that you can go and nation build in another environment. All right? So I agree that institutions are important. And you can actually build good and effective institutions over time. And actually, when you build good and effective institutions, they will regulate administrative behavior, political behavior. But who builds that institution? You need, in a place where there's no institution to speak of, you need leadership as the entry point. And it cannot be a leader looking down and talking down without an exchange of influence at the larger level of society. So I think our analysis has to change, but what also has to change fundamentally is the approach that we take. We can no longer justify a templated approach to going to environments afflicted by conflict and say that we have a solution that will bring peace. And I think this is a singular challenge, as I conclude, that the United Nations faces. On the panel last year, the challenge we grappled with the most was to begin to alter these narratives because of the persistence of conflict relapse. And I say persistence of conflict relapse, it looks like, you know, I'm mentioning the same thing twice. Every time we went to Haiti, we did the same thing. Every time that we went to Liberia, we did the same thing, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, and so on. The only time you see a break in that cycle, in any cycle at all, is when new ideas are introduced from the local environment. And therefore, if we're going to spend $1 billion or $800 million, which is what any peace mission that has about 15 to 17,000 troops will cost, then how many billions do we have to go back and spend in every single context before we know that it is not working? And yet we talk about building peaceful and inclusive societies. I want to argue that the places that will alter the narrative and the analysis are places like this, because your research will tell you something different. What you need, what the next generation of people will need, is the courage to research with integrity, the courage to tell the truth about the reality that you see on the ground without being forced, without forcing yourself to tell only one type of story, without only forcing yourself to provide only one theory that no longer works. And I think that's where I'll leave it. Thank you so much. Thank you.